Thank you. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to introduce one of my mentors. A couple of years ago, when her most recent book, Virgin Time, was released, I went to the bookstore here in Tucson to purchase a copy. And first I looked in the autobiography section because I knew it was a type of memoir, and I was not successful in locating it there. So I thought, well, I'll try the nonfiction section. And again, there was no copy of the book. So I thought, well, I'll try religion. It was not there either. So I asked the clerk to help me, and I asked if they had a copy of the book, and she said, well, yes, we do, but we didn't know exactly what sort of book to call it, so we placed it under general interest. And I think that Patricia Hampl's work is general interest in the very best sense of the term. She writes about things that I think really matter and that everyone can relate to, issues of family and faith and skepticism and the contemplative life. Among her books are A Romantic Education, Spillville, Virgin Time. She's also written two books of poetry, and I'm told that she's just finished a screenplay, so she continues to branch out into new areas. So I hope you will help me in welcoming Patricia Hampl. Thank you.
Well, he's taller than I am anyway, we know that. Excuse me. Hello, it's great to be here. I am not responsible for your bad weather, in spite of the fact that I come from Minnesota, which is the bad weather place for a lot of people. I'm hoping that it'll be sunny tomorrow, though. I feel that as a guest of the Poetry Center, I should at least read a poem or two before I launch into prose, which is what I've been up to for a long time now. So, bearing in mind that I do come from Minnesota, come to you from Minnesota, I'm going to read you a kind of Minnesota late winter poem. You know that because there's a lot of slush in this poem. And then I'll read one other poem before I launch into some prose. And this, by the way, is this poem has been done up as a broadside, and I'm giving the broadside as a gift to the Poetry Center. The poem is called The Moment. Standing by the parking ramp elevator a week ago, sunk, stupid with sadness, black slush puddled on the cement floor, the place painted a killer pastel as in an asylum. A numeral one, big as a person, was stenciled on the cinder block. Remember your level. The toneless bell sounded. Doors opened. Nobody inside. Then, who knows why, a rod of light at the base of my skull flashed to every outpost of my far-flung body. I've got my life back. It was nothing, just the present moment occurring for the first time in months. My head translated light, my eyes spiked with tears. The awful green walls, I could have stroked them. The dirt, the moving cube I stepped into, it was all beautiful, everything that took me up. And the other poem I want to read you is from, I can't really call it my latest book of poems, given the fact that this book was published in 1983, but in fact it is my latest book of poems. I want to read it in the spirit of something that I think lies at the heart of literary enterprise, and that is the friendships that sustain many of us over long years when there isn't a whole lot of other recognition of what it is that we're up to. And I know there are many people in the room who know about that, who have been sustained and who are sustainers of others as they give their lives to this strain of writing. And I'm thinking particularly of my colleague, Ted Wright, who has moved here from Minnesota at his retirement, and Allison Deming, a new friend, and others here, Dick Shelton, who brought me here in 1980, the last time I was in Tucson. This poem is called Last Letter, and it's for a poet perhaps not known to too many of you, named James White, not James Wright, but James White, the author of, among other books, The Salt Ecstasies. And he was a guy who lived in Minneapolis and was a friend of a lot of other writers, and he died at the age of 45, about in 1981, very early, of congestive heart failure. And I was at the North Shore of Lake Superior when I heard about it, and I wrote this poem for him. So although it's an elegy, and I don't mean to rope all of you people into an elegy in terms of the fellowship among poets, I do honor that fellowship that I think sustains writing over the long term. So this poem called Last Letter. Everything is more beautiful today. I'm sorry, it's not right when you're dead for the first time this morning. But the rain hits the black asphalt like a hoofer, exhausted, heavy under the transparent strokes of dance. The pink geraniums, do you like pink? I want to know if you like pink, are hanging in a basket from the cafe awning as dry as tissue paper in a package. The lights of things have turned on more intensely just now as yours has clicked immaculately off. The women at the next table are saying, something's cute, real cute. One of them with earrings the shape of hearts. No way would I follow that oaf around like she did. They're talking about love, the only subject, darling, except for this new one of yours. Here's what I meant to do. Call you this weekend, go for chicken salad sands at the Sky Room, and you'd whisper again the truth. The really great waitresses always chew gum. You approved of their dismissal of us, charmed always by any artist who couldn't be charmed. You posed glamour as the first honor of friendship, and we said darling to each other like movie stars. Your white, naughty smile. Tell me again, Trish, darling, how we're going to claw our way to the top. The woman with the hearts at her ears is saying that after 30 years of marriage, you can't expect, and that the girl wasn't a gold digger. She says, when you order prime rib, you just better not think you're going to get it medium rare. But the only words today are endearments, darling, sweet one, caro, caro. We like to be affected and spoke all languages for their flair. Just this instant, a cat streaked by outside, wet and matted as carpeting in a vestibule. His brown and black stripes were green in the rain. A green cat, Jim, bet you never saw that. And the hearts are gold, pressed tight against each lobe, not hanging, in case you thought I meant the hanging kind. No, pressed, like two kisses. And she's looking at the cat, too. She may be thinking about the cat or about something else. I can't say for sure. I'll keep describing things, getting the colors right, taking down the dialogue, packing the report with metaphor so it's art, watching the world be unlikely and eccentric. I call it honesty, as you do. But today, I call it keeping you alive just a little longer, using the present tense that's dishonest now, and it is unholy, darling, to hold you a second longer than you held on to us. The first little prose piece I want to read you is from a book called Spillville, which is named for a town, Spillville, Iowa, where the Czech composer Antonín Dvořák spent the summer of 1893, and in fact, it's from this book that I wrote the screenplay that Dan was mentioning, and which I hope someday will actually turn into a movie, and I can wear that non-existent gold lamé gown that I keep imagining myself showing up in somewhere, sometime, somehow. Anyway, this one I want to read, consists of a lot of short, very short chapters. I mean, they aren't even really chapters, they're just little flashes of prose about, with different titles. And I want to read this one in honor of Dan Cooper Alarcon, whose work on travel and tourism is engaging a lot of interest in a lot of students here. So I'm going to throw this one out, my little piece about travel and the idea of travel in relation to the Midwest and to Antonin Dvorak. The piece is called, and also it figures later in a couple of other things I'm going to read to you. The title of this little piece is Pilgrimage. God, the sky is blue and the air is shot with gold. A moment ago, we passed a farmyard where a girl about 12, wearing a blue and white dress, stood waving, dwarfed by a lilac bush whose blossoms were already rusted. She seemed to beckon, but of course she was just waving at the world, us, passing by. She would have been alarmed if we'd stopped, but the impression remains she was inviting us in. Now, on another side road, we've decided to stop for a picnic, spreading our provisions on a patch of rocky pasture overlooking the clean geometry of the fields below. Pilsner Urquell and green bottles, the heavy gold of Bohemian hops, cheese and salami set out on butcher paper, sweating in the sun. We rip off hunks of sourdough from a big loaf, grimacing like men tearing the Manhattan telephone directory in half. For dessert, there's Belgian chocolate so bitter it makes my eyes hurt. This trip is a variation on a theme. Even for Dvorak, the theme was already stated. Even he was making a pilgrimage. He sought the familiarity of his own language in the wilderness of English, and he came to the farmland and woods his secretary Kovarsik promised would remind him of Bohemia, a good place to compose away from the city he had spent the school year in New York. All that, true enough. But he sought as well, I think, the higher pitch, the experience of immigration itself. He could have found peace and quiet closer to New York. He could even have found other Czechs nearer to hand. But he could not have replicated his countrymen's experience of immigration without crossing the wider stretch of land. Dvorak understood, it is clear from his letters, that poverty, not idealism, was the heart of immigration. The poorest of the poor, he said, describing the background of the settlers of Spillville. He spent most of his afternoons in Spillville after his work was done for the day, talking to the oldest townspeople. He wanted to hear their stories. Dvorak came not to be an immigrant. That was, of course, not possible for such a celebrated man. But he could touch the experience, at least the hem of its cloak. Perhaps his coming here best understood as an oblique homage paid to immigration, the cruel, kind song that beguiled so many of his people. The summer of 1893, he made his brief bow to what he knew was not only his countrymen's emigration, but their banishment. The paradox: there can be no pilgrimage without a destination, but the destination is also not the real point of the endeavor. Not the destination, but the willingness to wander in pursuit characterizes pilgrimage. Willingness to hear the tales along the way, to make the casual choices of travel, to acquiesce even to boredom. That's pilgrimage, a mind full of journey. It's an adagio movement, the slow, lyrical mode of travel. Everything fits, as now, lying here, eyes closed, winter face to the spring sun. Flies, attracted to the sticky smell of flat beer left in the green bottles, are making a low, sizzling sound near my head. A wasp has zoned in on the salami, and I realize, touching my hand to my forehead, that my brow is furrowed. Somebody has put Dvorak's American Quartet on the tape deck and turned the volume up to the max. Our theme song, the piece he sketched his first few days in Spillville. The scherzo, modeled on the song of the scarlet tanager, is drilling itself over the pasture. A happy man wrote that. Dvorak ventured this far from home. The American Midwest was the farthest reach of his travels. Such an unlikely explorer. He was so hopelessly daunted by the carriage traffic in Prague, it is said, that he would ask a student to help him cross the street. What kind of pilgrim is that? A fearful one, the most authentic kind. Needless to say, when I was approached to write a screenplay about this very uncinematic movie, I thought I should maybe consult this producer a little bit about the wisdom of this, but the screenplay is very different in tone and in fact has a lot of different characters in it from this book. But that was an interesting experience to write also, very separate from this. Now, having spoken about Dvorak coming this way, I'd like to go the other way. And out of this book, A Romantic Education, I'd like to read you my first impression of Prague when I went there in 1975. I should mention that the other two books I'm going to read from, A Romantic Education and Virgin Time, are both memoirs. One is a memoir about growing up in a Czech family and going back to Czechoslovakia, and the other is about Catholic. And I don't know, you don't grow up, you know, deciding that you want to be a memoirist. I think a lot of people grow up wanting to be writers, but I don't think they think, I think I'll write my memoirs. You know, it's just not what you think of doing. And so to find myself locked, or at least living in this genre, seems very strange. And I always had a notion in my mind that I had two books I had to write before I could write the real books. And one was about being Catholic, and the other was about this Czech background. And I saw these two books as like those lions outside the New York Public Library. Prudence and, what's the other one called? Faith and Prudence? I don't remember those two lions out there. And I thought, when I write these two books, I can begin writing the real books. Didn't know it would take me till I was almost 50 to do them, of course, so I don't know what I had in mind about the real books. At any rate, I'm still waiting for the real books. I'll read you just a short description of Prague. Of course, it's the Prague, the pre-revolution Prague I'm describing. And then I'll read you another portion from an afterword, which I wrote for a new edition of this book after the revolution. A Romantic Education came out in 1981. So the first thing I'll read you is from that time. And then my publisher suggested I go back after the revolution and write an afterword. And so I'll read you a little brief section from that, which dates from 1992, I think. So, here I am in Prague. Prague stopped my tourism flat. The weight of its history and the beauty of its architecture came to me first as an awareness of dirt, a sort of ancient grime I had never seen before. It bewitched me, that dirt, caught in the corners of Baroque moldings and decorative cornices, and especially I loved the dusty filth of the long, grave windows at sunset when the light flared against the tall oblongs and caused them to look gilded. I walked around Prague, hardly caring if I hit the right tourist sites, missing Baroque gems, I suppose, getting lost, leaving the hotel without a map, as if I had no destination. I just walked, stopping at coffee houses, smoking unfiltered cigarettes, and looking out from the blue wreath around me to other deep-drawing smokers. Everyone seemed to have time to sit, to smoke as if smoking were breathing, to stare into the vacancy of private thought if their thoughts were private. I was in the 30s. I'd finally arrived in my parents' decade, the men's soft caps, the dove colors of depression pictures, the acquiescence to circumstance, the ruined quality. For the first time, I recognized the truth of beauty, that it is brokenness, it is on its knees. I sat and watched it and smoked. I don't smoke, but I found myself buying cigarettes. Smoked a blue relation between those coffee houses and me. For this sadness turned out to be, to me, beautiful, or rather, the missing quality of beauty, whatever makes it approachable, became apparent in Prague. I could sit, merely breathing, and be part of it. I was beautiful at last, and I didn't care, At last, I stumbled through the ancient streets, stopped in the smoke-grimed coffee houses, and added my signature of ash. Anonymous and yet entirely satisfied, I had ceased even to be a reverse immigrant. I sought no one, no sign of my family or any ethnic heritage that might be mine. I was simply in the most beautiful place I had ever seen, and it was grimy and sad and broken. I was relieved of some weight, the odd burden of happiness and unblemished joy of the adored child, or perhaps I was free of beauty itself as an abstract concept. I didn't think about it, and I didn't bother to wonder. I sat and smoked. I walked and got lost and didn't care because I couldn't get lost. I hardly understood I was happy. My happiness consisted of encountering sadness. I simply felt accurate. The Prague that I went to and discovered and wrote about was, of course, the Prague before the Americans came to it. In fact, I ended this book talking about how if only the American expatriates could find this town and live in it, they would overwhelm it. But of course, that would never be possible because it was a communist country and it would not be possible for people to come there. Well, now there are something like 30,000 Americans living in Prague right now and two English language newspapers. When I went back in the early 90s, I discovered a very different Prague, and I met some friends there, a hardworking doctor who took me on a tour, and an American who'd returned, having escaped in 1948, to receive his degree, which had been denied him when he'd been arrested. I want to read you about another person I met there in 91 or 92, another person like me returning, although this had been his home originally. The next day, meaning after some other things had happened, I managed to find the antiquarian bookshop in the worn of tangled streets behind Old Town Square, where Anna, my doctor friend, had admired a children's encyclopedia. I snapped up the whole set, The Animal World, it was called, for $15 as a farewell gift for her. Then standing outside the shop, trying to open my umbrella in a driving rain, I realized I would have to carry this bag of bricks around the rest of the day. It was this dispiriting awareness, I think, that caused me to decide on a long, expensive lunch. I dragged the Animal World to Prague's only kosher restaurant, a place that used to be cheap, Anna had me. But it had become popular with tourists, and the prefix menu was now out of reach for most of the people of Prague.